to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Been There, Done That. So the reason behind this week's episode, Been There, Done That, is from the premiership that the Penrith Panthers won many, not the recent ones, I mean the one back in like 2004 when Ryan Girdler wore a t-shirt saying, Been There, Won That, and I just thought it was one of the most clever t-shirts I'd ever seen. I always wondered, how is it that they knew to make all those shirts before the end of the game? No, that's a complete lie. That's not what we're talking about this week's episode. We're talking about the idea of feeling like the feeling that you get, very familiar feeling of really enjoying something very thoroughly for a very short period of time, and then sort of getting the ick after that said sort of short period of time, and very sort of dramatically or very suddenly moving on to the next thing. So we often see this in terms of how we feel about people, but also places, things, jobs, foods, all sorts of things I'm sure you can think about. And when we talk about this happening in the arena of food, places, people, whatever, and I think in the films we're going to talk about today, they can all sort of be kind of microcosmic or macrocosmic versions of each other. So the way some of the characters feel about a person could be sort of a microcosmic representation of how they feel about the place they're in, or vice versa, if that makes sense. And before we get into the actual films that we're talking about this week, I want to make it very explicit from the start that I'm very much aware, and I want you, dear listener, to kind of keep this in the back of your mind throughout today's discussion, that all three films, they kind of coincidentally, I'll put that in the bunny ears there, they're all very coincidentally they're set in sort of very cosmopolitan or sort of quasi or contemporary bohemian environments, i.e. all of the characters are some kind of like artistic or cultural or creatively minded, kind of open-minded, modern, progressive person living in a gorgeous European city who loves, you know, drinking wine and spending time at parties and dancing. So you could draw a through line between all these films and many other similar films we might briefly touch on if we have time, of a person kind of losing it at a fancy party while dancing on the dance floor. And there's that kind of contemporary, cosmopolitan, quasi-bohemian undertone in all of these films. And why I say, you know, is that a coincidence or not, is sort of in the quotation marks, is that I don't think it's, I think it's sort of a natural occurrence of these kinds of questions around, you know, been there, done that, moving on to the next thing. I don't think it's a coincidence that that's cropping up in films set in those kinds of environments, because those kinds of cultures, you know, the creative culture, the artistic cultures, they're at the precipice of culture itself. It's all about setting the new trend. It's all about finding the new thing to be fashionable. Being cool is all about doing something that no one else is doing and being the first to do it. And then once everyone does it, starting to move on to the next thing. It's a kind of like a radical form of progressivism, you know, being at the new thing, changing the world before everyone else, or in a way that no one else has thought of before. So this sort of idea about the burdens on both the world and the individual themselves when having that feeling of being there and having done that already. I think it does come up in all of these films, and films about kind of that modern European, you know, hoity-toity, let's sip wine, you know, in the alfresco dining area and smoke a cigarette and think about how cool we are because of all the music and the funny sunglasses and hats that we wear. I think it comes up in a lot of those movies. And maybe the loyal fans of the show know that we have kind of touched on some of these themes before. Certainly in that episode we did a couple of months ago on the conservative progressive dynamic, and how there's this sort of this, and it's sort of the kind of, everyone's sort of talked about it now, the kind of horseshoe theory process of, you know, when you go too far down the right or too far down the left, you kind of bend and become one of the same thing. You know, becoming super progressive actually ends up becoming super conservative, and then being super conservative kind of ends up being super progressive in different ways. So I'm conscious that we have kind of treaded in this terrain before, but we're going to talk about some pretty refreshing things. And I do advise that you jump back and have a listen to that episode as maybe some pre-reading for this one, if it gives you a little bit more steadier footing. But the films we're actually going to talk about, the first one we're going to talk about is Joachim Trier's film from 2021, big film of the year when it came out. I actually never saw it when it came out. I was very excited to actually give this film a watch final. It's been on the list for a long time. It's The Worst Person in the World. We're then going to move on to Iris Sachs's new film from this year, Passages. And then we're going to finish off with Paolo Sorrentino's Palme d'Or winning flick from 2013, The Great Beauty. But let's kick things off now with The Worst Person in the World. Now, if like me, you hadn't seen this one, I've seen it now, but if you hadn't seen this film, this one is about a woman named Julie, who is this, she's in her 20s. This is almost kind of like the Norwegian version of Fleabag, if you know that show. Our protagonist is Julie, and she's in her 20s, and she wanted to be a doctor at first, and then a psychologist, and then a photographer, and that sort of thing. And she meets this guy, Axel, who's this cartoonist, and they get pretty hot and heavy and into a pretty serious relationship. And he's a lot older than her. He's in her 40s. And then as the film progresses and their relationship progresses, she starts to, I don't want to give too much away because I don't think we need to really go too deep into the plot, but her eye starts wandering elsewhere, let's say. And then we see the issues in their relationship kind of come to the surface, but it's not a simple question of, you know, a love triangle. It gets a little bit more complicated than that. And she goes through it. I'm going to sort of go into this a bit further in a second, but it kind of goes through a fair bit of like a very difficult life situation, let's say, without giving too much away. And the kind of the main takeaway that I really want to focus on, particularly in the context of today's conversation, looking at this film, is that I think this film does a really unique, it's very unique in how it conveys this idea of the appearance of betrayal being in a kind of eternal tension with the individual's yearning to grow. So the outside world might look at us and see us as a traitor, and that'd be our kind of primary personality trait. But for that individual, they're kind of going through hell knowing that everyone feels that there's some kind of traitor to those that love them. But they cannot help this yearning to become a new person, to try new things, to individuate themselves better, to progress in society, particularly when you understand this dynamic where she's a lot younger than Axel is. So we've got this idea of sort of feeling negatively towards someone who lacks loyalty, but in their own heart, they kind of can't help but feel this natural and inevitable force to grow. And when you watch this film, when I watch this film, especially from like the context of, you know, what goes on in the world right now, I couldn't help but think that this is the kind of girl that you'd imagine like an incel would hate so much. Like, she's clearly got this very indecisive, vacillating personality where she can't choose something, and that's frustrating on like a superficial level, I guess. But also the way that she kind of, like, if you really wanted to sort of paint her in a bad light, you'd say that she kind of picks a new guy on a whim, and she kind of has no sort of insight into other people's feelings, and she just treats guys like dirt. And you could really look at her from a very pessimistic angle if you wanted to do wrong. But why I think the film is so powerful is that in its depictions of her desire specifically, it's so creative in how it depicts how she deals with her desires internally, and how she actually goes about the world, in how she actually navigates the world. And it's interesting. It's an interesting question of form, because the film actually does kind of have this sort of normal, down the line, independent European cinema realist kind of vibe to it. And then there's just these moments of surrealism to depict her desires. There's a particular scene, if you've seen the film, you know what I'm talking about, where everything sort of stops and she lives out this desire without actually having to live it out in real life. And so in doing that, I think that what the film does really sort of cleverly and maturely is it acknowledges how bad she is on the inside, right? It doesn't shy away from doing that. But equally, as much as it acknowledges how bad she is on the inside, you know, this supposed worst person in the world, it certainly acknowledges her strength in ultimately being able to resist what she actually deeply desires. It's almost like the more bad that she is, the more strong that she is in being able to resist those bad urges. And we can have a debate around, you know, whether she ever crosses the line in this film, but I think we could all sort of agree. I mean, it's a European film. I think the rules over there are a little bit different, but I don't think she ever does anything that's so drastically terrible that she fits that label of the worst person in the world. But if you were the victim, or what you subjectively consider yourself to be a victim of her actions, you could very easily put her in that basket and make yourself feel a lot better in your suffering and that sort of thing. And I think this film, well, I was talking about how it does this very uniquely, and sort of cleverly, even though those words kind of sound trite. I think the best way I could talk about how I feel about this film is that the film genuinely made me feel sad in a way that I can't think of another film making me feel sad, in the sense that the character feels so deserving of sympathy at certain points in this film. But that's made all the more worse by the fact that you can tell that so few people will give that kind of sympathy to her. It's almost like there's this sort of doubling down on how bad we feel, how sad we might feel for a person. Like if someone goes through something difficult, we feel sad for them. But it's even worse if you can tell that the rest of the world can't see that, and they still see them as a bad person. They still see them as that worst person in the world. And you look at her sort of being this very pretty young girl, and there's this sort of thing that makes you feel like, you know, no one's going to really see her as that bad a victim. Like no one's really going to see her as really going through it, because she is pretty and she is well off, and she's, you know, she's not going through anything like on paper, let's say, but that makes it all the more worse that we have this projection on her that she is doing fine, that she is a good that she is comfortable socioeconomically, socially, blah blah blah, sort of in all those sort of traditional metrics. But when we actually look at things from inside her, from her own mind, she's probably going through it. And as I said before, you know, the fact that no one else can see that makes it doubly worse. So we have this sort of, at the start of today's discussion, we're talking about this idea that desire and wanting to move on from someone can be from something that, you know, we should really be more sympathetic towards. But then is there a limit to how understanding or how sympathetic we can be towards people who are, let's say, burdened by their desire, let's say? But before we move on to our next film, I just remind you, are listening to 2XX Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here, and also jump onto our website to sponsor the show or subscribe to the station. We'd love it if you could do that. But moving on now to Ira Sachs's film from this year, Passages. It stars Franz Rogowski, who plays a young filmmaker named Thomas, and he's married to Ben Whishaw's character. It's a double Ben Whishaw. We did a Ben Whishaw film last week. He plays Martin, who's Thomas's husband. And then there's Agathe, who is played by Adele Exarchopoulos, who, you know, from things like Blue is the Warmest Color and big French actress of the day. And it's kind of like, again, this love triangle between these three, with Thomas being the one who's vacillating between Martin and Agathe. And I want to focus in terms of contrasting it with Worst Person in the World. I want to talk about how it explores the extent to which I think does a good job of conveying how the extent to which we indulge our desires is proportionate to the toll that it has on others. And this is certainly a point that we made when we talked about Maestro a couple of weeks ago, the new Bradley Cooper film, where sort of the broader you expand your love, the shallower it is for each individual person that you might love, particularly the ones you're supposed to love the most. And what I couldn't stop thinking about when I was watching this film is just how... it really is just a very classic and predictable linear story of, I guess, idealism. You know, the grass is always greener on the other side. You know, when you've ever love triangle, a person vacillating between two people constantly, you know, it's telling that age old story of like, you know, you're always just going to think the thing you don't have is the thing that you want more. Very much like akin to a film like Cold War, the Pavel Polanski film that we've talked about on the show before. And it almost has that kind of classic Marxist thing about it as well, which is, you know, the more that you put people through it, the more that you burden other people with your selfishness and your indulgence, the more that they're going to resent you. It's almost like two right angled triangles, you know, facing each other, and the hypotenuses are going in contrary motion. You know, the more selfish you are, the more people are going to have contempt for you, and the more they're going to want to revolt against you. And that all sounds very sort of derivative. But why I really like this film is that it feels so special despite having that kind of age-old quality to it in its sort of its bare morality or the morality on its face, because it gives us a really hard truth, I think, without giving too much away of the film. But I think considering the time in which this film is coming out and the context within that in which this story is taking place, I think it's giving us this very hard truth that's very bold, which is it's kind of telling this, lifting up this idea that we can't just play the victim card when we want to be really selfish and indulgent, right? When we want to engage in seriously debaucherous and self-indulgent behavior, we can't just sort of flick the victim card out and say, well, you know, come on, I'm sort of a member of a certain class, or I sit in a certain part of society where I should be forgiven for whatever I do. And there's a particular scene in this film, I think, we sort of see the ugly side of trying to flip that card out, which is if you've seen the film, the dinner scene where Agathe's parents are like reasonably concerned with the fact that he's going to be fathering her child, and he hasn't shown at any point in his life that he's responsible enough to do that. And he starts to play it out like it's some kind of homophobic thing that they're saying, and that he tries to put in those terms. And because they're quite sort of tolerant people, that they go, oh, no, and they start to appease what he's saying. But we all know that this is a very toxic guy, and it's got nothing to do with labels or groups or categories. He as an individual is just a very selfish person. And on some level, we have to draw a line, it's very icky to look at someone be that selfish for so long. And it's kind of got that, just that the more that he does it, the more we go, oh no, he's not doing it again. The deeper into that sort of opinion, we seem to find ourselves entrenched. And I think that's quite a bold move, because the context and the atmosphere that this film exists within is so discordant with those ideas, if you really think about it. Like, remember, this is a film about a young filmmaker living in Paris on the precipice of culture, right? It's not really a place for, the same old stories. It's the kind of place where you want to see new radical ideas, breaking free of old conservative values all those things about, being responsible and being nice to people. It seems like there's these age-old ideals and values persist no matter what. And we actually, no matter who we are, we eventually do have to rely on them, or do have to take them into consideration in making our choices in life. And I think this does sort of like lift up this interesting idea, this interesting like kind of philosophical idea, that this idea of like radical individualism, like being whoever you want to be, not letting society dictate who you are and what you do, it's kind of equally both this radically left-wing and radically right-wing idea, kind of depending on how you define it. It's an interesting fact that I personally think is really funny, is that if you take someone like Jean-Paul Sartre and Ayn Rand, who are from completely different ends of the political spectrum, they both talked about some version of radical individualism, but they're from completely different ends of the political spectrum. But what's really interesting to me is not only do they both talk about this idea of radical individualism, they're both born in 1905. It's almost like, you can have either like a Randian or a Sartrean kind of version of this, and they kind of go in two completely different directions, but you're ultimately kind of maybe talking about the same thing. I know it would make a philosophy professor sick, but there is something in that, I think. But it's left us in an odd place here, because on one hand, we feel empathy for those who are burdened with their desires, or burdened by their desires, when those desires, when our old desires are no longer novel. But the impact that can have on everyone else, if we just completely pursue our desires willy-nilly, eventually that's going to, make us seem like some kind of selfish psychopath, and no one's going to want to be around us. It's going to sort of have this sort of self-destructive quality to it. So is there a way that we can abandon the past without abandoning the past? Can we abandon the thing that we're sick of without abandoning the past altogether? And at this point, we're going to move on to our third and final film for today's discussion, which is The Great Beauty, directed by Paolo Sorrentino. And the protagonist is this fella named Jep. And I think we're going to talk about this, and we have to talk about the fact that it's very much playing off of the Fellini film La Dolce Vita. It's very clear, sort of even just in how Jep is dressed with his glasses, and he's this journalist. And if you've seen La Dolce Vita, which we've never actually talked about on the show, you can see that the clear connections in his profession and living in Rome and beautiful women and parties and having to toss up, whether you go after what your heart desires or what you think is the right sort of the thing to do that takes integrity and things like that. And so it certainly lifts up this idea that, that there's the life of the lavish life, and also the serious life, and the tension and the tragedy of being pulled apart by that kind of vacillation. But I think that the film goes a step further, and I'm not the first to say this, but this is kind of like the sequel to La Dolce Vita, in the sense that it's like if Marcello Mastroianni's character grew up, and that's who Jep actually is, sort of after he's been torn to pieces by this this vacillation and what he would actually think about the world and life and the best thing to do. And I think, I mean, from the beginning we get this idea, or from at least early in the film we get this idea that, some things like the glamorous life go stale pretty quick, and that needs to be contrasted with this kind of, other things seem to have this sort of significance that they inherit from ancient times or something like that, where I kind of feel like it's not really just the story of luxury's limitations in a sort of Wolf of Wall Street way, and that's kind of a signature of Sorrentino. But if we go back to how much this film is like La Dolce Vita, it's got this sort of collage or melange-y kind of vibe to it, in that it's just sort of like lots of different little short films in a way of him sort of walking around this odyssey through Rome and seeing kind of what you could say is like lots and lots of different types of beautiful imagery, right? Things that could be understood to be beautiful by different people in given contexts. And it really allows the audience to kind of wrestle with how all of these things stack up against each other, when all sort of thrown in the same pot, when we sort of zoom out and look at everything, when push comes to shove, i.e. kind of when, like, if you look at life sort of comprehensively in all its complexity and mystery, what kind of fizzes to the top as the true most beautiful things that are worth pursuing if you have all the money, all the power, and all the influence in the world? And if we're going to hover in that idea of complexity and mystery, I think the film is kind of quite explicit in its exploration of this idea. I mean, even from listening to me talk, you probably think, what is this movie actually about? Well, the bare form of this film, it is a very messy film. It does have that sort of collage-y, kind of melange-y idea where it's just lots and lots of different things thrown at you. I mean, there's a random scene with like a random giraffe. Like, you're kind of meant to get discombobulated and disoriented, because I think that does sort of mimic life. And I think, and so this sort of happens on a micro and macro level. I mean, talking about how the film itself is sort of very kaleidoscopic, but even in just like the party scenes, they're very circus-like. You can't really keep track of who you're looking at and what's going on. But there's also scenes in the film where they, almost like in the Ruben Ostad film, The Square, that there's like a very clear sending up of sophisticated cosmopolitan art that is just so ridiculous that it sort of eats itself. It's so absurd. And then there's also just like explicit moments in the dialogue where Jep talks about the complexity of existence and not being able to sum it up in words. Like, as an old person, you realize that life is way too complicated to put in sort of like bare sentences. And there's the great scene where he snaps at that old friend of his at the party and explains why she's full of it, and she has no idea what she's talking about when she's explaining, how the world is and how Rome is and all that sort of thing. And so in all that mess, in all that beautiful mess, what it all boils down to is that through this forest of rich Roman extravagance, we still see, in all the wishy-washiness of the stormy seas of cosmopolitan, lavish, luxurious, glamorous, yet ugly and chaotic Rome, we see the persistence of old, ancient ideas. And this is very similar to an episode we did a couple of months ago on the multiverse, New York. We talk about where you have lots and lots of different perspectives and infinite sensitive perspectives on things. You can only eventually resort to the ancient and perennial and sacred through lines that still persist through all that. Those sort of bold and clear wrinkles that underpin everything, that you can't help, you can't ignore them, even in all the chaos. You see these persistent ideas. And I think in this film particularly, and the fact that it's set in Rome is so important, but These images tend to be very sort of religious or very spiritual in a sense. There's a sort of sense of human spirituality that we can't ignore when we see it. When we zoom out of a film like this, we can't help but see that there is this clear motif of spirituality, this kind of needing to connect to something bigger than just, some kind of mere mortal idol, just some famous fashionable model. We need to connect with something greater than ourselves, something that feels like it understands the world way better than a human being can. And the film sort of like not so subtly reminds us of all this. It makes it very clear. There's a clear reference to the fact that at the end of the day, there are roots that underpin all human cultures in all their humanness and in all their human conditionness, right? There's the fact that they're maintained, those sort of classic archetypal human roots are maintained for centuries. The fact that they're maintained that long isn't in and of itself indicative of their importance, right? The fact that when I say the word Rome, about the Roman Empire, you think about that, or you think about the Vatican. You know, when you look at even pictures of vases and fountains in this film, you can't help but think of what they came from and why they're still standing. And you have this motif of the Colosseum. He looks over the Colosseum the whole time. The fact that when you look at the Colosseum, you know what you're looking at, and you know that it's an important thing. You know, when we consider this idea in sort of the broader context of today's episode, which is sort of centered on a sort of radically progressive, cosmopolitan, artsy society that's forever pushing the envelope culturally, we can't forget that the fact that even though we're trying to look forward all the time to the new thing, there's sort of these ghosts of the past that are never going to leave us alone. So if we're going to look at all the films together that we've talked about today together, we had this idea. We've had this idea throughout that it seems that as much as you want to push forward and leave things in the behind, there's this kind of ancient wisdom or perennial morals or perennial ideas, kind of like these meta narratives that crop up no matter how hard we try and escape them, they seem to crop up everywhere. In Worst Person in the World, we get this feeling at the end of the film that it's actually through this kind of very old fashioned kind of self-discipline and having direction in one's life and seeing oneself as the author of their own destiny being the way that our protagonist individuates himself. And you have to sort of look at the last shot and the last scene of this film to really get what I'm saying there. And then in Passages, we have this, you know, again, this age-old idea that, you know, selfishness begets resentment. It begets contempt. It doesn't matter what kind of cool alleyway or cafe or restaurant you're sitting in Paris in. That's going to be true no matter what, no matter how radical or how challenging or how anti-establishment you want to be. The more selfish you are, the more that you're going to hurt the people around you, and the more that's going to hurt you in the end. It doesn't matter how revisionist you are around that. That's always going to be the truth for human beings. And then the great beauty, this idea of, you know, the mere fact that things persist, the fact that you can't help but see beauty in certain things, the fact that when you see a crying nun, you know what that means, and you know how it makes you feel, and you know what you're supposed to feel in that. The fact that these old ideas remain, that in and of itself is proof that there's something sacred about them, right? It doesn't matter how many parties you go to, you're going to understand that certain things are sacred simply because they've lasted so long, and that indeed indicates something about them. So perhaps it may be the case that we sometimes feel that a person or a place or a thing has worn out its novelty, but that's not necessarily the destiny of all things, right? That can be the case, but it's not always the case, because while we may meet people or go places and try things that we feel that we're done with after just a few encounters, there are older, more ancient, more perennial and perpetual concepts that are forever traveling through and will never be done with us. Well, that's it for Sacred Cinema this week on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in, and please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX FM, and jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. That'd be great if you could do that. And thanks so much for listening. You can email me at contact@jimmyberlusconi.com if you'd like to get in touch. But until then, we'll see you again next week. Cheers.